Succession number 8663, roll number 2.
Reel 2.
Yes, we were very surprised at what had happened, and it was obvious to us then that the Japanese, it had to be the Japanese, were bombing Singapore. And obviously they were after the two ships that had been broadcast as arriving in Singapore a few days previously. And that knowledge was worldwide because it had been given out by, I think, the House of Commons. And we realised then that the Japanese were after us and we were in harbour.
Was the bombing very accurate?
Well, we never went ashore. We never had a chance to go ashore to see the results. But we had stories filtering back that it was very haphazard and not a lot of damage had been done, because we used to have postmen and people going ashore and that sort of thing, and we were anchored out in the stream. We did get information filtering back, but not a lot, and there was nothing to worry about. But shortly after that, we then heard that Pearl Harbor had been badly bombed and the American fleet attacked. We then realized that this was a moment in history, that America was obviously going to be in the war. Their fleet had been badly damaged. The Japanese aircraft and carriers were the ones that had done it, must have done it, it was obvious. And we then realised also that we were in a war situation, and everything was then blackout, and they were trying to black out the town and getting everything onto a war footing.
Did the Japanese attack in the Far East take you by surprise?
Yes, as far as I can remember, we didn't think that we were going there to fight a war. We thought that we would go there to deter, and that was the whole object of them broadcasting that we were in fact coming and that we had arrived. That was the whole idea. If we were going into a war and a war footing, I mean, there would have been pointless, and it would have been very bad indeed to have told who we were and how many were going to be there and all this sort of thing. And so I think we went there initially solely to deter and stop Japan coming into the war, which was obviously, they must have had imminent signs of this happening.
What did you and your shipmates think about the prospects of having America on Britain's side?
Well, this is what we'd always wanted all along. They'd helped enormously, we knew, in the Atlantic and things like this, when we'd have been during the first 2 years of the war, from 39 to December 41, when this other lot happened. And so we were very pleased. And it meant now that they were actually in, whereas before they were dragging their feet. And to all of us, it appeared that the Americans didn't want to get involved again. And we used to listen to news and things like that. And everything was that they had a very strong lobby of isolation to keep out of it. They'd obviously lost many, many men in the First World War, and they didn't want a repetition of the same thing in the Second World War. But once, of course, they bombed, Pearl Harbor was bombed, and a lot of their ships were sunk and damaged, and a lot of their sailors killed, it meant indirectly that they had come into the war, and they would obviously be on our side. And so we were joining forces against Japan in that area.
What happened to you next after the Japanese air raid?
Well, 2 or 3 days after that, we put to sea. And that is when the Admiral made this signal to us about going up to the north of northern part of Malaya, near somewhere up towards Bangkok, and that we would go up there. There was suspected that there would be a Japanese force landing, which had an old battleship called the Congo. And this old battleship was the large ship that was escorting this invading force of Japanese soldiers, and that they were putting in right on the northeast coast of Malaya. And we were going to go up there and sort them out and wipe them out. And he made this single and sort of gave, it was in the form of a sort of a pep talk, and that it would be a fairly easy job, and that obviously the signal can be referred to even now, and but the words and the gist of it was that we would sort of make mincemeat of them, and we would be able to come out of it and come through it with flying colours. And of course we did know, although we thought that the Prince of Wales was not all that it could have been, we did have a very modern battleship with us, so we did feel fairly strong. But again, we all thought we should have had an aircraft carrier, but subsequently, and I think it is a part of it, of the story, that I met a publican in Somerset when I went down for a weekend a few years ago, and he was on an aircraft carrier that had been designated to join us at Singapore, and he was one of the air crew. Unfortunately, this aircraft carrier ran aground somewhere, he told me, somewhere in the West Indies, and it never did arrive. And so the people in higher places must have realised there should have been an aircraft carrier there, which had made all the difference, because the whole gist of everything, all the way through the operation involving these ships, was that there was no aircraft of our own. And any of those that were about were antiquated.
What happened on the voyage to the northern part of Malaya?
The went fairly uneventful. The weather and everything was marvellous. It didn't seem like war, because the sun was shining, the water was like a mill pond, and I always remember we go up on deck, And you could sort of hardly any clothes on, because it was lovely weather, just like an English summer or hotter, and everything seemed so peaceful. And we were out of Singapore, I think, a couple of days, and we were making up for this northern part of Malaya, the northeast. And then, of course, we weren't a party to everything that was done or the reasons for doing it. But after about 2 days, we turned round and started to come back. And we were retreating away from the scene. And we had the destroyer escort, and of course the Prince of Wales leading all the time, fairly close to us. And we started to retrieve our steps, and also, we thought, coming back to Singapore. Well, I think it was coming back to Singapore, or thereabouts. And then on the way back, during the course of that day, I don't know why, but I do now because I've read about it, we were diverted into the coastline of Malaya halfway down from the north to the south, about the middle, Kuantan, I think it was called. And we went almost in close to the shore. And there had apparently been some sort of talk of another landing there. And obviously the officer in charge thought, well, the reason I should think that he retreated was because he was getting too... What he wanted to do was to strike the northeast Japanese naval force at dawn as a surprise attack. Although we had been given our location prior to that, so they knew we were in the area, and obviously they would be looking for us. But that was the idea, to strike them at dawn, wipe out the invasion force and make a hasty retreat, or even catch them at a night action. But anyway, we made for this other suspected landing, and unfortunately there was nothing there, nothing could be seen. And we'd been warned that Japanese aircraft were probably looking for us, and we expected action stations. In fact, I think we were closed up most of the time at action stations, and we expected trouble. And we then continued with our original course, coming south towards Singapore. And the next thing that we knew was the alarm bells going and the klaxons saying, meaning that there was action stations. One of the things which was rather naughty of me, and it does make a bearing on the story as it goes on, we had to be, I was only a young lad, and we had to be forever harried to always carry our life belts. But being rather big-headed, and fortunately, in looking back with hindsight, I didn't carry mine. And it was a large rubber sausage, which you tied round your chest, and you then did as best you could swimming with the life belt on, and it kept you afloat. But I never had mine, and I never did have it during the whole of the action and any everything that happened afterwards. And it did play a part in my surviving, in a way, by not having it. And I can go, I'll go into that later on. But action stations went, and we knew it was aircraft, and nothing happened for quite a long time. And then suddenly, and again, this was a very fortunate action on my behalf, we had a terrific explosion just forward of my position. I was in the port passage, which was a damage control position. And so we were there so that if there was any damage, we went to it and tried to repair electrically installations so as to keep the ship in a fighting condition. But unfortunately, we found out afterwards that there was a high-level bombing attack, and this bomb had landed somewhere just forward of our position, and it was a terrific explosion. We were all thrown along the port passage, sort of concussed, with an acrid smell of burning and cordite, and we didn't know what had happened, and the ship sort of jumped in the water. And with that, the person in charge said we had to come out of it, and because it must have landed just a few yards the other side of the metal compartments of the ship, which subdivided the ship. And we had the hatch down, and in the it was all bolted down, so to get up out of that passageway, we had to open a little trap door in the hatch, which you could do from inside, and then we all, one after the other, climbed through the hole and onto the same deck, which was level with the quarter deck, except that that deck had two big doors where you walked, stepped out, and onto the quarter deck. I don't know the name of the actual compartment, which it would be called, but we came out, and we were up on there, and some of us were hurt and dazed, and we were trying to gather our senses, and there was all hell happening, so to speak. There were a lot of people trying to, that hadn't been affected, trying to fight the damage and fires and do whatever was necessary, but we'd been lucky that we hadn't been hurt to any great extent, but at the same time, none of us were up to sort of fighting and the fires and whatever was going on, and we were left alone sort of sitting around and laying down, some of them, and that port passage was in fact evacuated.
What happened to you next?
Well, that went on for some time, and then we heard there was a lot of firing and different things all the time, and there was all hell let loose. And the ship, you could tell, was motoring and steaming at a really fast speed. And then what we really needed was fresh air, and somebody decided to open up the door on the port side, where you could step out onto the quarter deck. And then when I went out and stood on the quarter deck and took advantage of the fresh air, which was marvellous compared to what was happening inside, and there was about three, four, five people there, and we were then started to watch what happened, because we couldn't help very much with what was going on inside, because of all of our part had been evacuated. And the bomb, from that point of view, was very lucky for us, because it hadn't hurt us, but it had made us get out of the compartment we were in. And I've always felt that was the luck, because so many other people, especially in the torpedo branch, which one must remember was electrical as well, and a terrific majority of them were in damage control parties all over the different areas of the ship. And so it forced us out, and then I stood on the quarter deck trying to gain me wits and clear my head and gather, see what could be done. And I was so amazed, and this is the thing that's lived with me ever since, to look at the aircraft that were coming in torpedo bombing us. And it was that was what they was obvious, because you could see them when they got closer. And they were marvellous aircraft, and that's the thing that is so outstanding. They had a fleet air arm that was, its equipment was of a completely and utterly different generation. Their aircraft came in. We were aware that our torpedo bombing aircraft was Swordfish, that is a biplane or two wings, and their speed was about 90 miles an hour, and we'd seen them operate with Ark Royal and other British aircraft carriers and things like that. But these aircraft came in, they were only had one wing, and they were absolutely marvellous aircraft, and they flew in they at terrific speeds, quite fast, much faster than the 90 mile an hour of the Swordfish, and they were so streamlined. Their pilots pressed their attacks in so strongly, and there were so many of them, they dropped their torpedoes at a far higher height than ever we'd seen Royal Navy aircraft do. And they came in, and they were, the only way to describe it is that they were of a different generation. And we'd never seen anything like it at all. And you can imagine our horror and shock when we thought we were going to have a walkover, and it was all aircraft with rice paper and string and you know, obsolete things. But here was the most modern aircraft we've ever seen. We hadn't seen anything of America's aircraft, similar torpedo bombers, but these were absolutely out of this world. And I watched them drop their torpedoes. I was standing on the port quarterdeck, just by the door and ready to get back in if anything serious happened near me, and all the guns were going off, what guns there were, and of course I think some of the more low angles were firing at the aircraft. I could see the Prince of Wales, I suppose 2, 3, 4, 5 miles away, and just prior to this attack we were out there, the Prince of Wales was hove to. She wasn't doing anything, she was just standing there, and we were just hanging about when we could have got away, I think. But anyway, we were hanging about and sort of not going too far away from her, and then we had to dodge our own attacks. And we did dodge quite a lot, and that's why everybody on the ship thought that Captain Tennant had done a wonderful job. He combed the torpedo lanes time after time. Which is they drop the torpedoes and you try and get up between them, and he missed a terrific number, but in the end it would have to be inevitable with so many aircraft coming in from different directions. And I stood there watching them all, and I saw them drop their torpedoes, and then I saw the marks in the water, and one hit the quarter deck or on the port quarter, one of them actually struck, and all the water went up in the air just by me. And there was also a number of other torpedo strikes all down the port side. And there was a petty officer not far from me, a petty officer LTO, which was a leading torpedo operator. And he said, come on, we better get up on the starboard side. Because the ship, although it was going along at a terrific speed, the ship was beginning to keel over to port rather alarmingly, and then it was still trying to dodge the torpedoes. And again, it was still staying somewhere near the Prince of Wales, which brings you back to what I said initially about the Prince of Wales, that they seem to have been a sort of a Jonah, a ship which didn't perform very well, and it wasn't a very lucky thing to be with her. And we subsequently found, when we survived, that she'd been hit with a torpedo under the stern, and that her rudder was jammed or her engines buckled, and she was incapable. It was a repetition of the Bismarck again. If one knows the story of the sinking of the Bismarck, was struck by the torpedo bombing squadrons of the Ark Royal, and out in the Bay of Biscay somewhere there, and the Bismarck went round in circles, and this is what happened to the Prince of Wales. She was hardly moving and just staying there, and we kept on staying with her. She had the Admiral on board, and I think probably if we could have cut and run, we might have survived. But it's problematical. They might have caught us even at a later stage with more aircraft. But the thing is, we then shut the door leading out onto the quarter deck and bolted it with clips. It's an easy job. And then we went up through the inside of the casing and came out on the starboard side of the quarter deck. And the ship then was beginning to list right over to port, very, very much indeed. And I went up the metal stairway up onto the, what they call the waist of the ship, the starboard waist. But it was beginning to go over to port very alarmingly. And just above this ladder was an oilerkin, which is a multiple type gun of low calibre. And this oilerkin was being fired by somebody, and they were putting up a wonderful show, but it was only pumping single bullets up into the air against these marvellous aircraft, similar to a machine gun, except that it was one barrel, an oilerkin. And there were other guns still firing, and I stood by this oilerkin and watched him firing, and getting somewhere near as the aircraft were still coming in, attacking. And several times people had to be told to stand back and get out of the way, because he was swinging round and tracing the aircraft as it went and dropped the torpedoes. There was no more bombs came at all. It was all torpedoes. And I should think there must have been about 5, 6, 7 hits on the port side. And, of course, the battle cruiser is not a battleship. There's no big bilges or anything. So once they've nailed a battle cruiser like that, well then she hasn't the armour plating to withstand many armour torpedo attacks underwater. And so therefore she was mortally wounded. And the petty officer I was with in the torpedo branch, in fact he may have been in the damage control party, he said, "We're going to have to go over the side." And of course then people said, well, one or two near me said, well, don't go near the propellers, think of the propellers. And of course we went then along more to amidships, and a number of people, as the ship keeled over, there was air vents going down into the boiler rooms and the engine rooms, and I remember people with their hands trying to pull off all these wire mesh tops to let people that were coming up the vents to get out. And it was a frightening and harrowing time then doing that. And a lot of them were successful. But again, it was all hell was let loose, and it was still the firing, and the Prince of Wales was firing only just a short way away. And it began to dawn that we were going down, and also that the Prince of Wales was going to be lucky to get out of the situation. And so then, without my life belt, but I must say that in HMS St Vincent and the Royal Naval School at Greenwich, or at Holbrook, they made everybody, it was compulsory, to learn swimming. And one of the things I used to regret very much was being made to go in the swimming baths at these two establishments in the middle of the winter with ice and snow outside, and they made you swim and swim and swim, and I became an exceptionally good swimmer, a very fast swimmer. And I'm glad I didn't have that life belt, but it's not a good... I was disobeying orders, really. And we went, slid over the side with a lot of others that were going over, and my fear was that I would be sucked under or get caught up in the propellers or any suction of that type. And the ship, as it was going along, still at a fairly fast speed, I went over the side, and as soon as I was in the water and came to the surface, I swam away from it as fast as I could go. And as I say, I represented many of the establishments at fast speed swimming races and that. And I went as fast as I could for as long as I could before I had to take a breather. And one of the things that puzzled me as well, although it must have been because I was a good swimmer, was that I never even had a drop of oil on me, which I thought was amazing, bearing in mind what I later saw within the next few hours. And I never got struck with any splinters or bullets or anything like that. I never got any injuries. I survived getting off of the ship without even having a bruise. And then I swam so fast that when I looked round, the ship had gone, when I thought I'd better take a rest. And I looked round and I couldn't see the Repulse. And I was miles away from the main, well, not miles, but quite a long way from where all the debris and the people bobbing in the water and swimming, and I was on my own. And then as I looked to the front again, and I think you could see the land in the distance. If you couldn't see it, I knew that which way to go, and I knew it wasn't far away, say, a few miles, and I was capable of doing that. So I thought, well, I'm all right. But then suddenly in front of me, HMS Electra was nosing her way in towards where all the debris and the survivors were. And she was coming very, very slowly, and her crew were passing ropes over the side. And I remember wrapping one of these ropes round myself and tying it round, and two blokes up on the forecastle of the Electra crew hauled me up, and I grabbed the guard rails, and I was up on board, and I was probably the first one to reach any of the destroyers.
What condition were you in when you got aboard?
Oh, as fit as a fiddle. Yes, I never had anything. I had no oil on me, no bruises, and nothing at all. Perfectly fit as a fiddle.
So what did you do on board?
Well,